Welcome to Co-op Radio 102.7 FM, CFRO. You're listening to the Monday Brown Bagger. My name is Reginald Angus Argue. Before we begin, our first interview we did was the Chief Looking Horse with Channing and I pre-recorded earlier. We're going to have our good friend Ricky, who is a survivor from the residential schools. He's going to be singing a song. And go ahead, Ricky.
We are the people from America. Stand up with your brothers, America. America. First Nations people from the States, from the States. From the States.
Thank you very much, Ricky, for that song. We are now going to go on to our pre-recording that Tanya and I did earlier this morning with Chief Looking Horse. Chief Looking Horse is from South Dakota, from the Lakota Nation.
Hi, welcome to this morning's Brown Bagger. You're listening to Co-op Radio 102.7 FM, CFRO. My name's Tanya, and my co-host is Reg. And today we have a very special guest, Chief Arvo Looking Horse. We're really very honored to have him here. He was born in South Dakota in 1954, and he was raised by his grandparents, Lucy and Thomas Looking Horse. He learned the culture and spiritual ways of the Lakota. At age 12, he was given the responsibility of becoming the 19th generation keeper of the sacred white buffalo calf pipe. In 1986, as one of the spiritual leaders of the Bigfoot Riders, they initiated a prophecy known as mending the sacred hoop of the nation. In 1993, Chief Looking Horse traveled to New York with elders of different nations for the United Nations Cry of the Earth Conference. He organized the World Peace and Prayer Day in that is now on June 21st. And in 1996, he journeyed from Wahpeton Dakota Reservation, Saskatchewan, on the Unity Ride. In 1998, he spoke on sacred sites and freedom of religion before the special rapporteur of the UN. So he's done a lot. And we're very honored to have him here. Thank you for being here, Chief. How are you doing today?
Yes, thank you very much.
Can you tell us a little bit more about the significance of being the keeper of the sacred white buffalo calf pipe?
Yes. It is a spirit bundle that I take care of. And this spirit bundle has been in our family bloodline for 19 generations. And because it is a spirit bundle, it chooses its keeper. It chooses to be before the keeper makes a journey, a sacred journey to the spirit world, that the bundle, the spirit bundle tells would have returned and stand upon the earth as the white wolf would come. And this prophecy is coming about because of 1994, the first white wolf of capital was born in Zanesville, Wisconsin. And almost every year, a white wolf of cap has been born. So these are just a prophecy that we're in right now. And that's why there's so much that work that has put upon our people as First Nations people because our always is about peace and harmony.
Since you were first given possession of the peace pipe when you were 12 years old, and with everything that you have seen in your life, the suppression of your people's spiritual practices, what changes do you think that all of us are going to have to make in our own lives in order to reach a sense of peace within ourselves? That's quite a big question, but...
Yes, our prophecy is similar to many nations' prophecy all over the world, where there's six nations in towards New York and Canada, Eastern Canada. The six nations, they have a prophecy right. about the white deer, and they have a prophecy about the white tigers or lions in South Africa, and. But that's why it's so similar that brought about World Peace and Prayer Day, a lot of people are already knew the prophecy that these are changing times that we are in because of the white buffalo calf and all the white animals showing their sacred color. And we went to the United Nations, but I just spoke there as of May 1st and 2nd at the United Nations to talk about earth changes and climate changes and the prophecies about these white animals that we have to be the voice for the white animals and now that we're in that stage right now that we need to, it's everybody's responsibility to get in tune with Mother Nature and to no more violence or anger. We all have, we have to think about surviving in this time right now, how we can survive in the future generations. Because we need each other's help. And the problem that we had the last 100 years was not good. You know, there's a lot of individualism. There's no tribalism. Our ways are about tribalism. It's about helping each other as brothers and sisters. But the last 100 years was not good because it's about individualism and it's about brothers and sisters are fighting and nobody can get along and a lot of violence. A lot of people are speaking out of pain. But we're not supposed to speak out of from our pain. We take it to ceremony. So after we go to ceremony, then we can speak. After we go to ceremony, so we don't speak out of anger. So there's a lot of healing that needs to be done. So we've been. The riots won the knee mending of the sacred hoop in 1990, we've been talking about healing our communities and working towards a global community because of the problems that we're faced with on the reservations. People are faced with in a global community and we're from our ceremonies the water is very important. It's called Maniwichoni, the water of life, and it belongs in our ceremonies, but because that people are not appreciating life or that spirit water that is affecting our ways, and we're supposed to be using the medicine. be healthier people in natural way, natural medicine, and things like that.
When you met with the Dalai Lama and Desmond Tutu, what were some inspirational messages that those two particular gentlemen had shared with you, which you're now able to share with our listening audience?
I believe both gentlemen, they spoke towards global peace and which was and non-violence, but that's very good, and I'm sure that but the to me being going to South Africa or being Desmond Tutu, I think he was referring to in a political way that we need to have addressed the issues of bringing peace among people. But Dalai Lama, I guess he was more in a spiritual being a spiritual peace, and that might have been a year ago, he spoke in Boulder, Colorado, and he asked me to speak with him. So I had spoke before Dalai Lama, and he was a very powerful speaker, like we all witnessed that he can move people in a spiritual way. So I think that really, all of us, we need to find our own guidance in some way. And for me, utilizing world peace and purity, we're trying to empower nations. We're trying to empower people with their way of life, and so they can be proud of their heritage or their own medicine. And because the time that we're in right now, we're at the stage which is white. In our ceremonies, that like if you go to a Sundance, you go in on the west side, that we use like the black, then the north is red, and yellow is east, and the white is south. South is like the last stage that we're in. So we talked about that in our spiritual meetings, that where the white buffalo is showing their sacred color, which is white, is we're in the last stage. We don't, but the elders, the people don't very smart enough. The people have got to smart enough. And we need to really help people understand that what we're faced is like big winds, with earth changes, climate changes, and there's a lot of global disasters that will, as different viruses and sicknesses will continue if we don't maintain or bring respect back to grandmother Earth Mother. So that's what we're trying to get the message out to the world, and as First Nations people, we are the key in this the new millennium, and that's why we're very important to help the people, even the American people, stand stronger, because there's so much that are on their shoulders that it's very hard to do things to. But it's not only a group of people, but we need to capitalize on everybody's unity. Everybody has responsibility.
And we have one final question for you, Chief. We're running out of time. And the question is over our lives, many of us will suffer through very abusive situations where in some cases, these situations and unjustified actions done against many of us have taken a few of our brothers and sisters, as seen by Harriet Nahani, Frank Paul, Anthony Dudley George, and many others, which has created a gigantic hole in so many people's lives. If you could you share a few words of encouragement and hope with all of us?
Yes, last 100 years is that disease of the mind and the sickness just continues within our people, or in all people, because people have a job and they leave their we love, it doesn't matter who our relatives are and how they are, we still love them. We're supposed to love our relatives, no matter how hard it is, or pray for a person that has done wrong to you. And that's what the elders said. That's the hardest thing that you can probably do, is pray for a person that has done wrong to you. And because every day is the Creator give us this, that's what we call it. Every day is a mystery. But people don't realize it that way, that they already think about the whole future, but it's not that way. Like, every day is a great mystery, and we're supposed to get up in the morning and be thankful and not to have bad feelings, because that anything that we carry, we can hurt another person. So we have to find, pray about it, and if there's anything that is hurting you, or somebody has done something to you, and you let it go, then tomorrow's another beautiful day. So you find peace within yourself and peace within your heart. You know? So that's what our ways are about. But I know that there's a lot of people that having a hard time out there, and it is but our prayers goes out to all the people that are living that way too. So I know that things have to get better. Now people have to be become more spiritual to understand what we're faced with in this global community.
Well, Chief Looking Horse, it's been a real honor speaking with you, and thank you for your inspirational words. I hope we can have you back on again, and maybe even come up to Vancouver. Just to remind the listening audience, June 21st is Aboriginal Day, World Peace Day, Peace and Healing Day, find out where, usually here in the downtown east side, there's a gathering, and there's gatherings all over the world on June 21st. So thank you again, Chief Looking Horse. I don't know if you have any information you want to give people, a website or any conference that's coming up.
This year we're going to New Zealand for June 21st, and a lot of people are going over there, but again, it's all over the world, and our website is wolakota.org, wolakota.org, and we're trying to recognize it as an international holiday where people can unite their relatives or think about the future generations.
That's great. That's wonderful. So, again, I hope that you can come back on. Thank you for being on the Brown Bagger and Co-op Radio. And take care.
Well, thank you very much for inviting me to be here with you guys, and I'm just gonna play a song for you. Imagine there's no heaven. I wonder if you can. No hell below us. A brotherhood of man. Imagine all the people sharing all the world. Imagine no possessions. It isn't hard to do. Nothing to kill or die for. And not religions too. Imagine all the people living life in peace. You may say I'm a dreamer, but I'm not the only one. I'll hope someday you'll join us, and the world will be as one. Imagine no possessions. It isn't hard to do. No homeless. Nothing to kill or die for. No wars nor invasions. And not religions too. No Harper, no Bush. Imagine all the people sharing all the world. You may say I'm a dreamer, but we're not the only ones. There's a lot of us out there. I hope someday you'll join us, and the world will be as one.
Oh, thank you very much, Sir Hakim. That's Hakim from, he does a show also here on Co-op Radio. Flamenco Tango, or excuse me, Romantic Tango. And this is Co-op Radio 102.7 CFRO. You're listening to the Monday Brown Bagger. And my name is Reginald Angus Argue. I'm back now with our guest right now, and his name is Bill Lightbound. He's from the Haida Nation, from the Masset.
Masset Band, yeah.
And Bill is also been a freedom fighter for generation for many years, and he's seen a lot of stuff in his lifetime. What is one of the biggest changes, Bill, that you've seen in regards to how people are becoming more aware of what's happened in the past to the Aboriginal people here in Canada?
Well, I would say probably the final recognition by government that they have to deal with us, and that in fact we do have rights that they can't take away from us. Our rights, by the way, are registered and protected in the Constitution of Canada. So there is no government that has the authority or the ability to be able to take away those rights. Now, it's been extremely difficult for the citizens of this country to recognize that we do have rights and they must deal with us. But the fact that there is a so-called treaty-making process going on in British Columbia, I think, is a clear case of recognition of the existence of our rights, and they know that they have to deal with us.
And I was doing some research. I wrote a bunch of articles. One of the articles I wrote on was Iprawash, mm-hmm. in regards to the late brave Anthony Dudley George. It brings tears to my eyes every time I think of what the atrocities happened to that individual. And here was a gentleman. He was defending his ancestral burial ground. And he was standing there, and he was gunned down by a police sniper. And so during the inquiry, you had Clifford George. Clifford George was a World War II veteran, an elderly Aboriginal gentleman, extremely brave gentleman. And he stood tall. He wanted the truth to come. And, well, I have this friend over in Ontario who was also talking to people that were involved with inquiry. And Clifford George wanted to quit one time. And I remember sending an email over to my friend saying, you know what, if Clifford George quits, then, you know, why should the rest of us stand up? And I found out later that Clifford George basically returned, and he was more vocal than ever before. And I also found out that the gentleman was dying of cancer. And sadly, he passed away. And it just brings tears to my eyes whenever I think of that, because here's a gentleman when the latter part of his life, and he's passing away, and he's still fighting to the end. And, you know, it's brave people like that we need to basically make heroes, because they're the people that we have to learn from. They're the elders we have to learn from. And there was one thing. When Clifford George came back from World War II, he returned to find his mother's grave was turned into a trench. He slept the first night in a ditch, not knowing where his reserve was at. And what happened was, he was saying that he returned. He went over to Europe to fight the Nazis, only returned to find that the Nazis were here in Canada. Can you imagine how that gentleman must have felt? What were your thoughts there, Bill?
And in regards to Ipperwash, well, I of course, that was an example of what was going on. By the way, just so other people begin to understand, it wasn't just Ipperwash. There was Oka that happened before that, and at the same time as Ipperwash, there was Gustavson Lake going on. And that was an attack on the Aboriginal people in three different locations in Canada. And that was an undeclared war against our people. And, of course, that didn't reach the media. Most people have no idea that that was going on at the same time. And I don't know. I can talk more about Gustavson Lake because I was in there. But there was in excess of 400 Mounties surrounding 26 people in a spiritual camp. That was a Sundance camp. That's what we were there for, and we were surrounded by in excess of 400 RCMP, as well as a number of Canadian Army people, as well as six armored carriers, and all of the top troops, trained troops, killers in Canada and the Canadian Army were all there. And that was a real out-and-out war against our people. And the only thing that protected our people in that camp was the spirituality of the people and the help of the spiritual people around this country. That's how we survived. And they fired 77,000 rounds on the day they shot at us and never killed anybody. Now, that's a scary thought in itself, because these are the people that are supposed to be protecting Canadian citizens, and they fired 77,000 rounds. They were given the order to kill us all, and they never hit. Well, they did hit one person in the arm, and that was the only person that was actually wounded in that whole thing. So these things, I mean, you've seen pictures of what happened at Oka, and so what happened at Ipperwash was just a continuation of that whole thing, and it was all at the same period of time. And that was a real decision that was made by the levels of government to attack the Aboriginal people in this country. And we're into it again, by the way.
And if you take a look at Canadian history, the only thing that saved Canada from becoming annexed by a few elitists from the United States. Now, before I will want people to know that there's an awful lot of Americans who I consider to be my brave brothers and sisters. But there are a small group, just like there's a small group here in Canada, who want to have control over all of North America. So this small group, if it wasn't for the Aboriginal people, we would have been overran by this small group, because there wasn't really that big of British forces here. And so what kind of, you know, you take a look at the payment that was given back by the British, awarding the Aboriginal people with blankets that had infested by smallpox, and numerous other, you know, atrocities done against them. Could you tell us, did you experience the residential schools yourself?
No, as a matter of fact, I didn't. And fortunately, my mother did, and my grandmother, of course, were also in residential school. And because of the experience, my mother hid myself and my brothers and sisters away when they came to try and pack us off to school. So there are some of us that did escape. That weren't subjected to that. But that didn't change my responsibility responsibility to the struggle, because I had lots of relatives that wound up in there, and I know the devastating effects it has had on those people.
It sounds like when your mother hid you away, it sounds like you can compare that to when the Jewish people were hid away from the Nazis during World War II. And that's totally appalling that a country like Canada would have the brown shirts in place to carry out any act against any people here in Canada, because we are supposed to be a free-loving nation. Right off the bat, it begs the question, you know, with the color of our flag being red and white, I'm beginning to signify that the think that the red stands for the spilling of the blood of the innocent people. What is your thoughts there, Bill?
Well, I think the best example of what that kind of thinking is the residential school system. By the way, I was on the board of directors of the Aboriginal Healing Foundation for a number of years. So when I say the kind of things that I say, I say it from experience of having talked to the people who were subjected to that right across this country. I was fortunate that I was one of the board members that was sent to a number of locations where people were attempting to establish healing projects in the various communities. And when you hear the stories that I've heard over the period of time, you know exactly what the struggle is all about, and you know that we're continuously being attacked on a day-to-day basis. It's still going on. They're still stealing our children away. I think I was told the other day that something like 70% of the children in care are people of children of Aboriginal ancestry. Now, that's a continuation of the same process, and it's genocide.
And also, I remember a couple years ago, there was a report done probably about 5 to 10 years ago, and it said that 50% of the people located in the Canadian jail system at this time were Aboriginals. Now, Aboriginals only make up maybe 1% to 2% of the population. So that just tells you what kind of justice there is for people of Aboriginal blood. And also with Harriet Nahani, here is an elderly lady, a brave lady. She stood tall for the people. She let her voice be heard for the people. She even said, I watched Conrad Smith's documentary, and on there it said, you can have your Olympics, but just protect the animals. It's the only thing she asked for. And Justice Brown sentenced her to 14 days in jail. She gets out of jail shortly after that. She ends up in St. Paul, and sadly she passed away. And you take a look at the treatment of an elderly lady. Harriet Nahani should be a teacher somewhere because of the knowledge she has in her life. Why would we allow a judge like Judge Justice Brown to even carry out an atrocity like that to an elderly individual that we should be respecting?
Yeah. Well, I think, you know, that is an example that a lot of people know about. Harriet Nahani is... she died of pneumonia, actually, and they believe that she contracted that pneumonia while she was in prison. And if anyone has ever spent any time in prison, they know that it's extremely cold in there. And, of course, this was wintertime when she was in there, the time of year when it is cold, and she never really recovered from that.
And you were also involved with the Frank Paul inquiry.
Yes.
Could you tell our listening audience a little bit about what was the final outcome? An inquiry?
Well, just to bring people up to speed on that, I'll quickly explain what happened there. Frank Paul was an Aboriginal person from back east. He was Mi'kmaq, and he was one of those people that were the product of the residential school process, and it destroyed the heart and soul and the culture of an awful lot of our people, and he was a good example of that. He wound up being more or less an alcoholic and living in Vancouver. On the streets. He was one of those homeless people, and he had to drink every day. And he had been picked up by the Vancouver police many, many times. And on this particular day, they picked him up in the morning. They said he was drunk. They kept him locked up for 3 hours. And apparently he was sober enough, they just released him. They picked him up a number of hours later, and he was comatose by this time. So they claim he was had been drinking a lot. But when the police took him into the police station, the sergeant in charge refused to allow them to leave him in there. And he said, well, he's not drunk because he couldn't be drunk because we just released him like 3 or 4 hours ago. And so he ordered them to drag him out of there. And dump him where he usually hangs around, somewhere up around Broadway, and I'm not sure what street, but Broadway anyway, on the west side. And they dragged him out all right and into the wagon, and in the meantime they got a call to go to a location where there was some conflict going on, fighters or whatever. So the driver went there and picked up those people, and a couple of policemen that were there on site, they said, he said, well, what am I going to do with this guy? Because he was laying there comatose. He was not awake, or, you know, like he was right out of it. And they said, just dump him off in behind the rehab center. So he dumped him off, and he was found about 5 or 6 hours later, and he was dead in the alley. That's where they dumped him off. So it took 10 years to get a public inquiry, and they never ever had a proper hearing. The people that were responsible for his death in the police department were never ever confronted. What really happened in the end is the one that was driving the truck was given 1 day suspension, and the sergeant was given a 2 day suspension, and that was so that they couldn't be tried twice. And I mean, it's ridiculous, one day and 2 days. And it took us 10 years and a lot of effort by our people to finally force the government to call a public inquiry into what was going on there. It's completed now, and the last day was a week ago Friday, and we're now awaiting for the commissioner, Justice Davies, and his final report. Now, what is holding that up, of course, is that the Attorney General's Department refused to allow the prosecutors who were responsible for either laying charges or not laying charges against those police, they refused to allow them to testify. The commissioner insisted that they testify. He made a ruling, which is a legal ruling, and they still ignored it. And what happened is the Attorney General's Department appealed that decision. So today is the day it's to have gone to the appeal court this morning. I have no idea what happened in that hearing yet, but I suspect that what is going to happen is the appeal court will verify the ruling of the commissioner and will insist that they appear. And I'm sure that what the Attorney General will do then at that point is he will appeal to the Supreme Court of Canada, which will stall it again. That's my opinion. Now, I hope I'm wrong, and I hope, in fact, that those three prosecutors that are in question here will be forced to give evidence, and if they do, it will be reconvened, and I expect to be there and listen to what is going on.
Well, Bill, I hope you keep the Co-op Radio listeners updated, because the listeners really need to know what's going on. And with alternative radio, that's what the people are starting to find their knowledge from, is because they're not listening to mainstream. Mainstream has a tendency of only giving a little bit of the facts and then polishing over top of it with stories that should not even be in the press to begin with. With that said, we have our other guest on the line right now. His name is Grey Wolf. He's a director of Save Our Tribal Youth. He's also involved with a production company. He's partnered with Alfred Panther, runs Grey Wolf Production, the only Native American-owned company that does the casting wardrobes and props for motion pictures, as well as TV. Hello, Grey Wolf.
Hello.
Well, thank you for coming on today, for agreeing to come on.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
And the first question I have to ask you, I also have another brave gentleman in the audience, in the studio with me right now, by the name of Bill Lightbound. He's from the Haida Nation. And the first question I have to ask is for you. You were telling me about California and the atrocities that have happened down there to the Native Americans and how the Catholic Church ties into it. Could you tell our listening audience about that?
Well, the mission system here in California was very, very destructive to the native people. You know, my brother-in-law was tribal chairman of the Chumash tribe, which is by Santa Barbara on the Santa Ynez Reservation. And you know, I'm not from this area. I'm from Tucson, Arizona. That's where my people come from. But when I heard about all the destruction that was caused by the mission system, I just felt like I had to say something about this because it has been devastating to our people here in California.
And what are the numbers of Native Americans that have been killed over the years in regards to California? I remember researching through stuff that some of the articles you wrote where it talked about 300,000 Native Americans living within California. What were the numbers that as they started to get wiped out by the few elitists?
Well, I mean, first year after contact, half the tribe is gone. You know, mm-hmm. first year, that's mm-hmm. just through disease and outright murder, and then the following year, half that is gone, and then we keep going on and on. You know, it just becomes more destructive. You know, because the native people here were not immune to the diseases that were brought by the Spanish. So, you know, and then people don't realize up until the late 1800s, it was still legal to kill native people. There was actually hunting parties that would, you know, form just to go out and shoot native people. And, you know, a prime example, you know, 1850, the Bloody Island Massacre, which was just a horrendous thing to the Miwok and Pomo people up in the Clear Lake area. You know, but these things are just not one incident, but many, many, many. Before I started studying about the California people, I was like stunned, you know, because you hear about Wounded Knee and you hear about Sand Creek and you hear about the Longest Walk and all these horrible, horrible, horrible things. And then when you get to the California history of the tribes here, it is even more devastating, you know, just unbelievably devastating what's happening.
Yeah, and also here in Canada, we've also had horrific treatment a few elitists have done towards the Aboriginals up here. The British gave blankets, which were infested with smallpox, which wiped out an awful lot of the Mohawks. And also we had Newfoundland, where the British were trying to wipe out the tribe in that location. And what they did was they said, okay, $200 for every Aboriginal brought in from Newfoundland. And you're looking at it, and you're going at what the British monarchy did was that this slowly but surely they've done genocide against culture after culture here in North America, where a lot of the history has disappeared over time.
Absolutely.
I think the Beothuks from back there are a good example of the effort that was made to eliminate the Aboriginal people in this country. The last Beothuk was killed about 60, 70 years ago, the last surviving one, and there are no Beothuks left. They're gone. They're all gone. There's not even one left. So that's a good example of the kind of genocide that was being brought against the Aboriginal people in North America, and it was all over North America.
Well, you know, another example is that you can go to La Purisima Mission, which is in Lompoc, and you can see that the Aboriginal women were actually locked away from the men, and they have birth records going back, you know, so many years, and every year it was less and less because the women were locked away. They could, of course, they couldn't have kids, and so that was a way of birth control, but also a way of genocide because they were killing out the people. There were way more dying than were being born. And this is a way to wipe out a culture, you know. And today the California tribes, a lot of people look at the California tribes, even our own people look down on them because they don't have a language hardly anymore. And culture and tradition is missing. A lot of big pieces are missing. Some have managed to keep some and a lot have not. But it was not their fault. This was something that was imposed on these people. And we have to understand that, you know, nobody gives up culture and tradition readily and language. And today we're all struggling to, you know, grab as much as we can and save. And I honor the Chumash and the other California tribes for trying to save as much as they can, you know.
Could you tell us a little bit about your the Save Our Tribal Youth, which you're a director of?
Okay. We set it up as I was talking to a young lady from Canada, Brenda Everett, and she was telling me about how horrible the conditions were at some of the reserves up there. And they parallel pretty much what was happening down here.
Mm-hmm.
So to me, because this is the seventh generation that we're in right now, and the seventh generation is so important because it's the generation that's going to bring back our people to where they should be, I kept thinking to myself, wow, we're not doing a very good job of trying to save our seventh generation, which is supposed to save our people. So I, with Brenda and a couple other people, Kathy Solomon and Kathy Kingerly from One Spirit, got together and said, you know, let's put this project together to try and sponsor young kids on the reservations, find sponsors for them out here, and see if we can get these kids to school and to even the bare necessities in some cases. You know, we had a blanket drive for Pine Ridge. We had all kinds of clothing drives, you know, to try to get these people through the winter time and hopefully save our tribal youth, which is what I'm trying to do.
Is there a website that people can go to look up to get more information, and even if they wish to give any donations,
yes,
where they can send stuff to?
Okay, and I want to tell everybody that 100% of the donations go back to the people. We do not take anything for administration costs. In fact, I had to reprimand a couple of my people that were working for us because they were taking shipping out of their own pocket. And it was getting to be a huge burden on some of our volunteers. And I said, you can't do that, people. You know, we look for monetary donations to do the shipping of all the different things we get. You can go to myspace.com/SOTY or Save Our Tribal Youth.
And also,
we also have a regular website, which is, I'm like the worst because I've got so many projects going at one time that I can never remember where I'm at. But if you go to the MySpace there, then you can go to the regular website.
And also, when you're talking about the atrocities on the different reserves, I grew up on the northern tip of Vancouver Island, a small town called Port Hardy. And there was three reserves in that location. I'm not of Aboriginal blood. I'm of Celtic heritage. And I feel a kindred spirit with the Aboriginal people because of the atrocities I've witnessed in my life, even being in the military and even being forced to leave Canada for almost a duration of 5 years because of my writing. A few elitists didn't like what I had to say.
Right.
But, you know, there's one reserve where I was taught when I was in grade two. I quickly say this to you, is that these words stick in my mind, the back of my mind, and this is going on 33 years now. I'll be 41 this year, and I was taught when I was 8 years old, and the words were, yo, weeksus ekman, and that was taught from the bill, I hope I get this enunciation right, the Kwatsino.
Yeah, Kwatsino is correct.
And what happens is that means, hello, how are you doing? And I can remember clear as day that Aboriginal elder that came into our classroom and was teaching it. And it's just the back of my mind. It stuck in my mind. And, you know, there was one reserve there in Port Hardy where they had the Aboriginals that they were drinking Lysol.
Oh.
And this one reserve, what happened was is that it was a bunch of different tribes made up, all slapped together in one. What they did was they went up and down the Vancouver Island, and they started gathering all the Aboriginals together, and they threw them together in one location. And here's people that, you know, their ancestors had been warring with each other in the past. Now they're stuck in the same reserve.
Right.
And you're looking at it going, well, who gave us the right to do that? You know, you take a look at what the British did. The British did over in Ireland. My ancestors, the potato famine, you know, my ancestors who come from Scotland, how they were mistreated. And you keep looking at it, and it's always a select few that wants to push their agenda upon the rest of us. And I think the only way that we're able to correct that is to stand together and say, we are all brothers and sisters in this fight for freedom. And that's why I keep on saying brother and sisters, because I feel that we're all related. We're all standing for the exact same thing. And that, you know, as my family motto, Blazon of Arms, goes for the RQ clan, it says, the hand is a pledge of faith, sincerity, and justice. And, you know, and I thank you so much, Dick Grey Wolf, for coming on and talking about that.
It's my pleasure. You know, I live in the city of Simi Valley in the state of California, where it's a very beautiful place to live. And, you know, people don't understand why I get involved, because you know, I'm a musician, I'm a actor, not a very good one, but I do movies and TV shows, and I have the production company, and I'm also the curator of the Chumash Indian Museum in Thousand Oaks. I have all these projects, but people don't understand that when one of my people suffers, one of my tribal people suffers, I suffer.
Yeah.
And we all suffer.
Yeah.
And so we do have to all come together, and we have to do what's best for our, to keep our people where we should be, not where we're at.
Well, thank you very much, Sir Grey Wolf. We have to go on to our next guest.
All right. Thank you.
And the listening audience, if you want to check out Grey Wolf's work, it's at myspace.com/Grey Wolf Productions. That is his MySpace address. We are now going to go on to our last guest, is Betty. Hello, Betty.
Hello.
Hi, Betty. We just have about a couple minutes. Could you quickly, when you're doing your book signing, you were talking about Harriet Nahani.
And, yes, I was.
You were talking about Harriet Nahani.
Yes.
And you were talking about the gray, the red frogs. Red-legged frogs. Yeah, I have about four things in my mind right now. I do apologize. Trying to battle a cold, too.
Red-legged frog, yes. A week or so after Harriet and I were arrested, she called me and said she was going to go back up to Eagle Ridge Bluffs to say a prayer for all the dead and dying things up there. And I said, no, Harriet, I don't want you to do that. You'll get arrested. You're not well. You have health problems. Please don't do this. And she says, Betty, I have to. It's my duty as an elder. And I want to say prayers for the red-legged frog. Well, it's red-legged is the official name for them. She calls them red-footed, and I guess that's what perhaps her people call them. And she says, because we have this story in the Pashtut tribe. She was Pashtut, and she says that when the last, because there are wetlands in the Eagle Ridge Bluffs, and there were some red-legged frogs up there, reported to be up there, and she says, well, when the last red-legged frog dies, all of humanity will die. And I thought about New Orleans and how that's where I was raised, between New Orleans and Baton Rouge, and how all of that had been changed. That was wonderful wetlands that had been drained and developed and nothing there to hold back the hurricanes. And when Hurricane Katrina came in, it devastated everything because of the destruction of the wetlands. So I said, okay, Harriet, wait for me. I'm coming with you. And we went up there. And the police swarmed us immediately. But Harriet says, I'm going to say prayers for the dying things up there and the dead things. And they let us go. They followed really close behind, sort of encircled us. Like we were this huge, huge threat. And Harriet sang the songs for the dead and said the prayers. And then we left and came back. And, you know, there was no mention of that in court. Nobody wanted to talk about that or bring it up that we had been even up there. I think people were ashamed. And so, Harriet was very meaningful to me. I think she's probably the bravest person I've ever met.
Well, thank you, Betty, for saying that to our listening audience. And we only have about one more minute left. Can you quickly tell the listening audience where to go and order your book? Because you're reading your book, and there's an awful lot of passages in your book which were very humorous, and it talked about your time in prison. Could you quickly give the website address where people can go to get a copy of that?
Yes, just for the time being, just email me, Betty_... Crosswick. That's KRAWCZYK@Shaw.ca, or go to the Workless Party office. That's at 2250 Commercial Drive. They have a lot of copies there.
Well, thank you very much, Betty. This has been Co-op Radio 102.7 FM CFRO. This is Monday Brown Bagger. And until we meet again, I say to the listening audience, just get really informed about everything and have a beautiful day.
Hey-ya, 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 hey. Hey-ya, 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 oh, hey-ya. Hey-ya, hey. Hey-ya, 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 hey. Hey-ya, 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 ho, hey-ya. Hey-ya, hey. Hey, yeah, oh, hey, yeah, hey, yeah.